The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We are reading this week from the April 16th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a restaurant called Sal's. Looks like it's a small Italian restaurant. Standing in the open door is a bouncer-looking guy, a big beefy guy with a T-shirt that says security. He's got his arms folded, and he's talking to a couple. Looks like they're coming for dinner, and they have their phone held up. They're showing it to him. In the foreground, we see just a hand with a QR code on it that says vaccinated and has details about the person. The headline is Proof of Immunity. Should private businesses require customers to have vaccine passports? We'll get to that story at the controversy of the week. But I also wanted to note that this is a special 20th anniversary issue. The first issue of The Week magazine was April of 2001, and they've got several articles about that. In fact, the main story headlines this week are Corporate Leaders, GOP Battle Over Election Laws. The second main story is U.S. Hits Vaccine Milestone as Variants Spread Fast. But I think it's worth starting with an article in the special section on the 20th anniversary. And it's called 20 Years of History and the Evolution of the Week. A short history of the week. We launched this magazine into a world very different from today's. This is why we've thrived and what we've seen. By William Falk, Editor-in-Chief. The week was born amid a strange stillness. In April 2001, the furor over the contested 2000 election had subsided, and George W. Bush was just 100 days into what one of our early covers called the Quiet Presidency. The nation was at peace, and the partisan rancor of the Clinton impeachment was, for the moment, in remission. It was so placid that summer, in fact, that newspapers and TV news paid inordinate attention to several shark attacks on the East Coast. There were times we struggled to find the meaty, idea-driven debates that are the heart of the magazine. But in this stretch of historical flat water, the faint sound of rapids could be heard. In our July 6, 2001 issue, the briefing in our magazine was headlined, Osama bin Laden's War on America. We all have our 9/11 memories. Mine is rounding a corner on my way to the week's Midtown office on that mild morning of blue skies, minutes after the second plane hit the South Tower. All traffic had stopped on Fifth Avenue. People stood in the street, gaping at the obscene gashes in the towers, the tongues of orange flames, the sinister black smoke billowing forth. Two planes? I asked a cop. He nodded, and our eyes met. We both knew what that meant. America was under attack. Our brief vacation from history was over. From that day forward, we have not lacked for news and controversy. The magazine boasts, with a wink, that we curate and distill all you need to know about everything that matters. Since 9/11 ruptured the world, everything has been a deluge. During these two decades, the U.S. has launched two enduring wars, battled ISIS, suffered a catastrophic financial collapse and recession, endured innumerable heartbreaking mass shootings, elected its first black president, legalized gay marriage, waged bitter culture war, expanded health care coverage, saw the internet permeate virtually every aspect of our lives, witnessed the rise of the Me Too and Black Lives Matter movements, put a New York City real estate tycoon and reality TV star in the White House, conducted two impeachments, and survived an assault on the Capitol and an attempt to overturn an election. Over the past year, a bat virus from China infected 130 million people, paralyzed the world, and killed nearly 3 million, including more than 550,000 Americans. What a stretch of history it has been. Horrifying at times, thrilling at others, deeply transformative and consequential. The unique format of the week has given me, and I hope our readers, an education along the way. A tour through ideas and perspectives from some of the best journalists, thinkers, and critics here and abroad, as they help us try to make sense of it all. The Week is a magazine of curation. We gather, filter, and distill news and opinion from hundreds of newspapers, websites, and magazines. When we group differing perspectives, liberal, conservative, libertarian, and unclassifiable, in one place, and bang them against one another in a dialectical pursuit of truth, a kind of alchemy occurs. Insights, patterns, new ideas, and even wisdom can emerge. Dots get connected. Where things stand becomes a little clearer. At times, there are glimpses of what comes next. I wish my staff and I could claim credit for inventing this clever format, but we are instead its fortunate inheritors. The Week began in 1995 in a converted London garage. Co-founders Jawyan Connell, a veteran newspaper journalist, and Jeremy O'Grady, a former British film censor, created a new magazine to solve a problem. Most Londoners read only one of the nine national newspapers, each with a distinct political and demographic niche. Wouldn't it be better if the differing worldviews of these publications were herded into one arena and pressed into debate for the enlightenment and entertainment of busy readers? This was the Week's founding promise. This clever new publication emphasized lively, succinct writing rather than wordy, self-important journalese. Brevity and clarity were its hallmarks, with a heaping helping of wit and deadpan British irony. Amid serious discussion of weighty matters, the Week had a twinkle in its eye, a willingness to be amused by human foibles. That twinkle can be seen in the distinctive illustrated covers of the Week, which derive from a long British tradition of political satire in such magazines as Private Eye and Punch, as well as in features such as It Must Be True, I Read It in the Tabloids, Not All Bad, and Good Week, Bad Week. One of the Week's earliest fans was an eccentric British publisher and entrepreneur named Felix Dennis. So convinced was Felix that the two chaps in the garage had come up with a successful idea that he bought a piece of the magazine from them and later full ownership, while they continued to write and edit it. In April 2001, Felix launched a U.S. edition of the magazine to great skepticism. "Is Felix Dennis mad?" asked the Wall Street Journal on its front page, noting that the market for news and opinion weeklies was already crowded with such venerable titles as Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report. But Felix was a true entrepreneur, a gambler who trusted his gut. "I have one talent," he often said, "and that is knowing what people want 2 minutes before they know it themselves." I'd like to report the Week was successful in the U.S. 2 minutes, or even 2 years after our first issue, but we were not. To make a long story shorter, which is what we do here at the Week, our readership steadily grew into the hundreds of thousands, and we began turning a profit 15 years ago, to Felix's great satisfaction. He passed away in 2014, knowing he'd been right. we continue to flourish. In the early days, internet journalism was still in its infancy, and our office was piled high with newspapers and magazines. Our editors spent hours tearing out or photocopying articles like patches of fabric for the new quilt we made every week. Over time, our research process has migrated mostly to online versions of our source publications. In place of the 9 British newspapers that originally formed the basis of the week, we now draw from hundreds of publications here and abroad. In each issue, we quote from more than 200 sources after sifting through thousands of articles for the wheat, not the chaff. Our busy, intelligent subscribers essentially hire our staff to read everything they don't have time to read and give them a pithy report. Here's what happened this week. Here's what smart people are saying about it. And here's where it may be going next. How do we do what we do? I am often asked. Some wonder if we use an algorithm or spreadsheets or some other automated tool for processing and crunching thousands of articles. But no, we read. We read for hours every day. The news staff, including managing editors Thaneus Bates and Mark Gimian, reads U.S. news and business sources. Our deputy editorial, International, Susan Caskey, reads and translates publications abroad. Our art staff, headed by Deputy Editor Chris Mitchell, consumes a wide swath of cultural coverage and reviews. As we read, we compile lists of stories, grouping these on the same topic together, and begin to discern the shape of the next issue. What are people talking about, arguing over, wondering? What books, films, music, theater, and consumer products deserve your time, attention, and money? These questions constitute our algorithm. The hardest part is the writing. Brevity requires compression, and compression requires struggle and sweat. I apologize for such a long letter, Mark Twain once said. I didn't have the time to write a short one. Before writing short ones, our writer editors read through a pile of news stories and opinion columns that can number in the dozens, and then in a few hours rewrite them into a 500 or 700 word article that is sprightly, clear, and densely packed. In our opinion-based pieces, such as Main Stories, Controversy of the Week, Talking Points, and the reviews of our arts pages, the week's writer-editors weave arguments from several sources into a coherent essay, a round-table discussion of a single topic with multiple points of view. If I may be immodest, it's an art to do it well. Our articles take readers on a tour of ideas, information, and perspectives, giving them the raw materials with which to form their own opinion. For those who already hold strong opinions, our articles can illuminate how the other side thinks and why. This exercise in open-mindedness often leads to seeing the world as more gray than black and white. Truth is always elusive, but in my experience, it generally can be located somewhere between the extremes. The Week is a nonpartisan magazine, and we view all politicians and political parties with appropriate skepticism. I often say that The Week has one bias, and that is for evidence. We operate under the assumptions that intellectual honesty and consistency matter, and that ideas should be openly discussed, not suppressed. In giving readers a menu of conflicting ways to see a given issue, we believe that mere assertion carries little weight. If you contend, for example, that the sky is green, you need to back it up with some persuasive factual evidence. Show us why we should believe the sky is green. Because I say so, or this is what my tribe thinks, isn't a serious argument. Sorting good faith argument from nonsense has, I must admit, become more challenging in recent years. Conspiracy theories and disinformation have gone mainstream. Social media and partisan news outlets cynically churn out blatant falsehoods like counterfeit bills. Over the past 20 years, the partisan divide has widened and grown more bitter and tribal. Our politics is in the grip of negative partisanship, knee-jerk, irrational opposition to the other side, and everything those awful people say, want, or think. As a cautious optimist, I would like to think we've already hit rock bottom on that descent into mindless polarization. I see signs we have started on the way back up to more civil, intellectually honest, and open-minded debate. The weak is where you'll find it. Succinct, lively, and with a twinkle in our eye. I hope you'll continue on the journey with us. And now for the controversy of the week, as described in our cover drawing. Vaccine passports, a ticket to freedom or tyranny? Vaccine passports don't even exist yet, but have already become the latest flashpoint in the culture war, said Molly Roberts in the Washington Post. With more than 100 million Americans now vaccinated against COVID-19, several states and private software companies are developing smartphone apps and paper certificates that would let vaccinated people enter bars, ballparks, and other businesses with some confidence that their fellow customers aren't disease vectors shedding coronavirus. Like face masks before it, proof of vaccination is demonized by right-wing politicians and media as a dangerous liberal assault on liberty. The passport proposals smack of 1940s Nazi Germany, said Representative Madison Cawthorn, Republican from North Carolina. Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene called passports Biden's mark of the beast. Despite this silly foaming at the mouth, said Mariel Garza in the Los Angeles Times, the Biden administration has explicitly ruled out issuing a federal vaccination mandate or a passport. Instead, it's several states and private businesses that are working together to develop scannable proof of vaccination. But Florida's lib-trolling Governor Ron DeSantis and Texas Governor Greg Abbott immediately banned private businesses in their states from requiring proof of vaccination. Vaccine passports would certainly speed up our return to normal life, but demagogues on the right see them as another tool to keep their base angry and afraid. Fear is warranted, said Michael Brendan Daugherty in NationalReview.com. Vaccination and natural immunity from prior coronavirus infection will soon mean the new COVID cases will drop precipitously, so this unnecessary biosurveillance regime would serve only to turn vaccine skeptics into scapegoats who couldn't work, travel, shop, or enter public places. Many liberals would welcome that revenge. Though I'm a libertarian, I reluctantly favor passports, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. The unvaccinated will impose a serious cost on the rest of us by creating a reservoir of disease that can spread and mutate, rendering our vaccines less effective and perhaps requiring a new round of vaccinations. Still, we must provide exceptions for people who can't get vaccinated for legitimate health reasons. A free society should be wary of setting conditions for participating in public life. We impose such conditions all the time, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Children and teens cannot attend schools or camps or colleges without proving they've been injected with a range of vaccines. If you want to drive a car, we make you take a test, carry a license, and show it to police if stopped. Somehow our own republic has survived these impositions without collapsing into an Orwellian dystopia. So I think we can probably handle getting your smartphone scanned on your way into the gym. Besides, said Anthony Fisher in BusinessInsider.com, wasn't always a core Republican belief that private businesses have the right to choose their customers? When a Christian baker refuses to cater a gay wedding, conservatives applaud. But if that same baker refuses admission to people who can't prove they don't pose a risk for spreading a virus that's killed over 550,000 Americans, suddenly he's an enemy of liberty. The libertarian conservative position on passports is incoherent, said columnist Will Wildenson in modelcitizen.substack.com. No unvaccinated person has the right to pose a risk to the health of the entire community. Let's call the passport hysteria what it is: blatantly self-serving tribalism. And here's our Good Week, Bad Week feature. Good week for GOP inclusivity. After Axios.com reported that former Olympian and reality TV star Caitlyn Jenner is exploring a run for California governor as a Republican against Governor Gavin Newsom, who is facing a recall election. It's a good week for Googling your symptoms after Harvard Medical School researcher found that despite how much doctors hate cyberchondria, patients are slightly better at diagnosing at what ails them after consulting Google. And it was a good week for Vladimir Putin, who is officially the most handsome man in Russia. According to a poll of 2,000 Russians, neither actors, nor athletes, nor other politicians can compete with him today, fawned the pollsters about the strutting, often shirtless, 68-year-old dictator. But it was a bad week for nappers who are dreading a return to working in an office because it may mean surrendering their afternoon naps, according to a report in the Wall Street Journal. One survey of 2,000 employees found that 33% took naps while working from home. It was a bad week for white saviors after Cher raised eyebrows with a quickly deleted tweet lamenting that she wasn't in Minneapolis on the day of George Floyd's death. This is going to sound crazy, the 74-year-old music and film legend tweeted, but maybe if I'd been there, I could have helped. It was a bad week for sacrificing for the cause after former President Trump called on his supporters to boycott Coca-Cola, whose CEO has criticized the new Republican voter laws in Georgia, but was photographed the next day at Mar-a-Lago with a bottle of Diet Coke imperfectly hidden behind his desk-mounted telephone. Our briefing article this week is titled, "The Latino Vote: Trump's inroads among Hispanics in the last election shocked Democrats. What happened? Aren't Latinos reliably Democratic? Not after last November's election surprise. With some 61 million Latinos in the U.S., Democrats have dreamed of a day when the fast-growing Latino vote gives them decisive majorities in Sunbelt states like Florida, Texas, Arizona, and Nevada. But President Trump actually improved his results among Latino voters in 2020, getting 32% of their vote, according to exit polls, 4% more than in 2016. This improvement came despite his frequent attack on Hispanic migrants as criminals and invaders, his policy of deliberately separating children from parents at the border, and his widely panned, ineffective response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. While Joe Biden still won the national Latino vote by 2-1, he lost Florida largely due to having just a 5-point edge among Latinos, compared with Hillary Clinton's 27-point advantage in 2016. Democrats' hopes of swinging Texas were dashed when Trump narrowed the Latino margin there by 10 points. Down ballot, Hispanic support for Democrats slipped 9%. What drew Latinos to Trump? A combination of factors. His fierce opposition to abortion resonated with many Latinos, about three-quarters of whom are Christian, including many devout Catholics. Trump targeted Latinos whose families fled socialist regimes in countries such as Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Colombia, branding Democrats as socialists and even communists, and warning that Biden would be the far left's Trojan horse in the White House. The left's campaign to defund the police also alienated many Latinos who fear urban crime and make up about 13% of local law enforcement and nearly 40% of Customs and Border Protection. Latinos who become citizens after immigrating legally often resent being associated with the plight of poor illegal immigrants. When Sergio Arellano of Arizona was 18 and in the Army, he went to register to vote, asked what separates Democrats and Republicans, and was told that Democrats are for the poor and Republicans support the rich. "That made it easy," Arellano told the New York Times. "I didn't want to be poor. I wanted to be rich, so I chose Republican." Many Latino men who've built businesses of their own admire Trump's success and wealth, as well as his pugnacious, no-apologies attitude. Why was that appealing? Many Latino men were raised in traditional households with socially conservative values. We were brought up the old school way, that men are men, they have to provide, and there's no excuses, and there's no crying. If you don't make it, it's because you're a pendejo, said Ricardo Portillo, 45, of McAllen, Texas, using Spanish slang for idiot. Last year's election revealed a stark gender gap. Biden won Latino men by 23 points, but Latinas by 39 points. And the divide was even more dramatic in swing states like Nevada, where Latinas favored Biden by 47 points, but Latino men by just 6 points. Latino women are more likely to attend college, while many Latino men in the South work in oil fields and fear the impact of environmental regulations. They are also turned off by the gender-neutral term Latinx, preferred by academics. Just 1% of Latino men in their 20s use it. How else do Hispanics differ? Country of origin is a huge factor. Cuban refugees who fled to Florida in the 1960s after the rise of Fidel Castro have long gravitated toward anti-communist Republicans. They were given quick paths to U.S. citizenship and voting, and their political power grew as a result. Today there are 2 million Cuban Americans, but 3 U.S. senators of Cuban descent. There are also 3 U.S. senators of Mexican ancestry, but nearly 37 million Mexican Americans. How Latinos identify racially also shapes their politics. Many Hispanics whose families immigrated generations ago identify as white, and 32% of U.S. Latinos view themselves more like assimilated European immigrants than people of color. Biden did 50 points better among Latinos who feel more in common with black Americans than with whites. What's the future of the Latino vote? Republicans are optimistic. They point to Texas Rio Grande Valley, where Trump lost rural Starr County, which is 96% Hispanic, by a mere 5 points, compared with 60 points in 2016. Democrats, meanwhile, are banking on the disproportionate youth of U.S. Latinos. 22% of Generation Z voters are Hispanic, and 1 million Latinos in the U.S. are expected to turn 18 every year for the next 2 decades. Hispanics are adamant that both parties should stop treating their vote as monolithic and must stop taking it for granted. A few ads in Spanish, they say, won't get it done. Latinos are engaged like never before, said Antonio Arellano of Jolt Action, a Latino civic engagement organization in Texas. They know that the next chapter of American history will be written by them. Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. The U.S. can vaccinate the world. The United States ought to commit to vaccinating the whole world this year, said Dalibor Rohak. Buying and distributing 16 billion doses of vaccines would cost about $300 billion, and it would be both an act of self-interest and leadership. Much of the world, including the European Union, Australia, Japan, India, and Africa, lag far behind on vaccinations. And global partnerships, Gavi and COVAX, hope to distribute just 2 billion doses by the end of 2021. That means the coronavirus will continue to infect millions and mutate for years, possibly evolving to become resistant to our vaccines. The longer it takes to reach herd immunity on a global scale, the longer we will have to live with travel restrictions and vaccine passports, not to speak of face masks, nasal swabs, and quarantines. Paying for a global vaccination program would be a bargain, given that the pandemic will have an estimated cost to the U.S. of $16 trillion by this fall. American companies, workers, and travelers would dramatically benefit from a truly effective global war on the pandemic, and it would buy us enormous goodwill. Let's go big and, not for the first time in history, save the world. Taxing the rich won't suffice. Progressives are afraid of taxes, said Henry Olson. To pay for $1 trillion stimulus and infrastructure plans and expand the social safety net, Democrats always say they're limiting their tax hikes to the rich. But the trouble for the left is that you can't pay for the government they want by taxing only the rich. Every social democracy in the world has far higher tax rates for the middle class than the U.S. Canada pays for its single-payer health care system and extensive social safety net with a national 5% sales tax, provincial sales taxes of up to another 10%, and a top income tax rate in Ontario of 46.13% on incomes of more than $175,000. In the UK, taxpayers get hit with a 40% tax on incomes of just $52,100 and 45% at $208,600 without standard deductions. That comes on top of a 20% value-added tax on all goods and services and a $3 per gallon gas tax. In Denmark, the top tax rate of 55.9% kicks in at $86,500, and there's a 25% value-added tax. If progressives want a social democratic utopia, they'll have to persuade middle-class Americans to pony up and pay for it. This column comes from France. Is Europe just a doormat for Beijing? If Brussels is going to go toe-to-toe with Beijing, said Sylvie Kaufmann, it had better be ready for the consequences. Last month, the European Union joined forces with the UK, the US, and Canada in sanctioning four Chinese officials involved in the mass internment of minority Uyghur Muslims. Brussels was expecting a tit-for-tat response of the kind seen in rows with Russia. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, three expelled diplomats on one side, three diplomats on the other. But Beijing hit back with full force, sanctioning 10 EU lawmakers, diplomats, and experts on China. When Beijing's ambassador to Paris was summoned to the foreign ministry for a dressing down, he simply refused to go. Europe is not a doormat, raged Clément Beaune, France's minister for Europe, but I'm not so sure. The EU announced a major investment treaty with Beijing in December, and ever since has been waving it around like a diplomatic trophy. That suggests to Beijing that Europe is more concerned with trade than with holding China to account for human rights abuses. Sooner or later, EU leaders are going to have to face up to this dilemma. Either back down in the face of China's bullying or scrap the trade deal they went to such great lengths to secure. We've got an interesting topic in our Last Word article this week. The headline is Traveling Toward the Light. For decades, psychiatrist Bruce Grayson has been collecting stories of near-death experiences, said journalist Alex Moshekis in The Guardian. That hasn't brought him any closer to an explanation. When Greg Nome was 24 years old, he slipped into the churn beneath a waterfall and began to drown. His body pummeled against the sandy riverbed. What he saw there surprised him. Suddenly, his vision filled with crystal clear scenes from his childhood, events he had mostly forgotten, and then moments from early childhood. They were memories, if that's what they were vivid and crisp. Was he reliving them? Not quite. They came at high speed, almost all at once, in a wave. And yet he could process each one individually. In fact, he was able to perceive everything around him, the rush of the water, the sandy bed, all of it brilliantly distinct. He could hear and see as never before, he recalled later, and despite being trapped underwater, he felt calm and at ease. He remembered thinking that prior to this moment, his senses must have been dulled somehow, because only now could he fully understand the world, perhaps even the true meaning of the universe. Eventually, the imagery faded. Next, there was only darkness, he said, and a feeling of a short pause, like something was about to happen. Nome recounted this story at a support group in Connecticut in 1985, 4 years after the experience. He had survived, but now he hoped to understand why, during the moment of extreme mortal crisis, his mind had behaved the way it did. The meeting had been organized by Bruce Grayson, now a professor emeritus in psychiatry at the University of Virginia. As Nome spoke, Grayson sat in a circle of 30 or so others, as if at an AA meeting, listening intently, nodding along. Grayson had been hearing of events like these for years. A month into his psychiatric training in the 1960s, he had been confronted by a patient who claimed to have left her body while unconscious on a hospital bed and who later provided an accurate description of events that had taken place in a different room. This made no sense to him. I was raised in a scientific household, he says over Zoom. My father was a chemist. Growing up, the physical world was all there was. He felt certain someone had slipped the patient the information. He also thought, what does that even mean, to leave your body? For years he tried to put the account behind him, but repeatedly he faced heady stories of people experiencing otherworldly events, either when they had been pronounced clinically dead or thought they were close to it, before being wrestled back to life. In the 1975 bestseller, Life After Life, the psychiatrist Raymond Moody, once a colleague of Grayson's, labeled these episodes near-death experiences, or NDEs, a term that stuck. It occurred to me for the first time that this wasn't just one patient, Grayson says. I plunged in, he continues, and here I am, 50 years later, trying to understand. Grayson is now 74. When we talk, he is at home in Charlottesville, Virginia, waiting out the pandemic in a pressed shirt and tie, kind and affable. Over the years, he has collected hundreds of near-death experiences, he says, either from people who, aware of his research, have volunteered their stories, or from patients who happen to have episodes in the hospital. In those cases, Grayson's process is nearly always the same. He sidles up to the bedside and gently withdraws information. I ask, what's the last thing you remember before you blacked out, he says. Then, what's the next thing you remember after that? And finally, and what do you remember between those times? Not everyone reacts well to the questions. Most people stare at him blankly. But around 1 in 5 will say, well, you know, I thought I saw my father who died 20 years ago, and I say, tell me about that, and I let them go. Grayson presents his research in a new book, After, which is bound by a series of case studies. The accounts are mystical, like those we know from TV and books, but there are common themes. After a bad reaction to anesthesia, one patient recalled, I found myself in a meadow, mind cleared, identity intact. The meadow, she went on, was lit with this glorious, radiant light, like no light we've ever seen, and a gentle inner glow shone from each and every plant. Most episodes involve similar feelings of wonder, mental clarity, and bliss, Grayson says. Some people recall out-of-body experiences or report traveling through a long tunnel. Others meet entities they think of as God or Allah or long-dead family members. It has been Grayson's role as a psychiatrist to provide a space in which experiencers feel comfortable retelling often incomprehensible stories. Though even when patients discover the courage to try, they can struggle to find the right language. When I talk to near-death experiencers, one of the first things they say is, I can't put it into words. There's no way to express this. A frustrated experiencer once told him that when he tried to recall events, I always fall short. Given that near-death experiences happen with limited warning, they are almost impossible to test. We're dealing with a very short space of time, Grayson says. A swimmer is trapped underwater. A roofer falls from a ladder. A bystander peering down at his phone is struck by a car. And after, Grayson points out that his career has coincided with advances in brain imaging technology, including the emergence of fMRI scanners, which help neuroscientists observe thinking in action. But what happens when an experience occurs randomly, nowhere near a hospital? How do you capture a moment as fleeting and unannounced as the point of near death? When I asked Grayson why he decided to publish after all these years, he explains that we had to wait until we had enough knowledge about near-death experiences to be able to understand what was going on, by which he means not that we know what NDEs are, but that advances in science have allowed us to rule out a heap of things that are not. There are physiological hypotheses that seem plausible theoretically, he says, but none have stuck. Are feel-good chemicals like endorphins released into the body at the point of peril, creating euphoria? Does the brain become starved of oxygen, prompting real-seeming fantasies? Nobody knows for sure. We keep thinking, oh, it's got to be this, Grayson says. No, the data doesn't show that. Oh, then this? Well, nope, the data doesn't show that either. At the University of Kentucky, the neurologist Kevin Nelson, who, like Grayson, has spent years recording NDEs as a kind of academic side gig, thinks of the experiences as a blending of two states of consciousness, wakefulness and REM sleep. During a time of great physical or emotional danger, and argues that many NDEs are dreamlike, existing in a neurological borderland. Other researchers, including the late neurologist Oliver Sacks, have thought of NDEs as extremely complex hallucinations, an idea that, if nothing else, seems culturally accepted. When Grayson mentions his research to colleagues, he receives a variety of reactions, from, are you out of your mind, to, oh, let me tell you about my near-death experience. To formalize NDE research in the 1980s, he developed a survey, the Grayson Scale, which has been translated into more than 20 languages and is still in use. Did you suddenly seem to understand everything? Did you feel a sense of harmony or unity with the universe? And he has been published widely in respected medical journals. But he can have quirky ideas. In After, Grayson writes, I take seriously the possibility that NDEs may be brought on by physical changes in the brain, though he also accepts that the mind might be able to function independent of it. There have been reports of people experiencing near-death episodes while their brains are inactive, he says. And yet that's when they have the most vivid experience of their lives. Partway through our conversation, he asks, are these the final moments of consciousness or the beginning moments of an afterlife? These kind of theories put Grayson on wobbly ground among neuroscientists, who mostly agree that the mind is a product of the brain. Of the afterlife, Nelson told me, this claim is the most extraordinary in science, and there is no ordinary, let alone extraordinary, scientific evidence to support it. Sachs called claims like these anti-science. Grayson knows that events in near-death experience are important to corroborate. We can't do research on a deity, he says dryly. But still, he finds it tough to dismiss wackier theories, even if the data isn't there. When I ask him what his current logical understanding is, he looks resigned. It seems most likely to me that the mind is somehow separate to the brain, he says. And if that's true, maybe it can function when the brain dies. Then he adds, but if the mind is not there in the brain, where is it? And what is it? Last year, my 4-year-old son and I watched Soul, the Disney film, which introduces the near-death experience to a new audience, very young people, and examines consciousness, the afterlife, and the imperceptible stuff that makes us, us. Often in these screen-based times, we are encouraged to celebrate narratives that promote living the right way, which tends to involve appreciating and accepting every moment for what it is, and mindfully placing experiences and relationships above the pursuit of power or prestige or material goods. Broadly speaking, this is the plot of Soul. Most of us do not live like that, not entirely, and yet we feel like we should, lest we waste our precious time on this planet. Which is why near-death narratives fascinate us and why they persist as events of interest in the culture. They ask, what would you do with your life if you had another chance? To Grayson, the impact near-death experiences have on people's lives has been his most surprising discovery. I make a living by trying to help people change their lives, he says. It's not easy to do. But here I found an experience that, sometimes in a matter of seconds, dramatically transforms people's attitudes, values, beliefs, and behaviors. Often these changes persist over decades. In most instances, experiencers realize they are no longer afraid to die, which has a profound impact on how they live their lives. Because you lose your fear of life as well. You're not afraid of taking chances. Grayson sometimes asks people to describe their partners before and after an event, and they'll say, yeah, this isn't the person I married. This is someone different. He adds, they see a purpose in life they didn't see before. I don't know of anything else that powerful. I ask for an example. I've spoken to people who were policemen, he says, or career military officers, who couldn't go back to their jobs, couldn't stand the idea of violence. I ask why, he says. The idea of hurting someone becomes abhorrent to them. He shrugs. They end up going into helping professions. They become teachers or healthcare workers or social workers. I ask if Grayson's research has changed the way he thinks. I don't think it's changed me in terms of my relationships with other people, he says, except that it's made me more accepting, more open to unusual ideas. As a psychiatrist, he remains aware of what it means to be psychotic. But, he says, I'm more accepting of unusual thoughts that aren't crazy, and it's made me much more conscionable with the unknown. I grew up without any kind of spiritual background, he continues, and I'm still not sure I understand what spiritual means. I'm convinced now, after doing this for 40, 50 years, that there is more to life than just our physical bodies. I recognize that there is a non-physical part of us. Is it spiritual? I'm not sure. Spirituality usually involves a search for something greater than yourself. for meaning and purpose in the universe. Well, I certainly have that. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in The Guardian. And we'll wrap up the show as usual on the Talking Points page. We have an article here titled Religion, Waning Influence in the U.S. Americans are losing their religion, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon.com. Over the past 22 years, a new Gallup poll found the number of Americans who say they belong to a church, synagogue, or mosque has fallen to just 47%. Down from 70% in 1999. Why the exodus? Blame the religious right. Evangelical leaders' embrace of Republican politics and homophobia have turned many people off, particularly their hypocritical fawning over former President Trump, a thrice-married chronic adulterer. The non-affiliated were driven away, said Leonard Pitts, Jr. in the Miami Herald. The Catholic Church's massive child sex scandal deeply undermined its moral authority and the religious right's cynical decision to align itself with Trump, a biblical illiterate who broke commandments like glass, was the final straw. If you are seeking spiritual guidance and solace, are you going to be drawn to people who revere Trump like a golden idol? Fat chance. The collapse in church membership is bad news for liberal democracy, civility, and comity, said Matt Lewis in thedailybeast.com. Every human being is hardwired with a deep-seated impulse to worship something and seek transcendent purpose. If organized religion is no longer filling that need, then people turn to politics, and often to demagogues like Trump. Philosophers have even argued that Nietzsche's God is dead proclamation abetted the rise of Hitler and other 20th century authoritarian regimes. On the contrary, America's record godlessness should be welcomed and embraced, said Phil Zuckerman in the Los Angeles Times. Nations that have seen the most secularization, including Scandinavia, Australia, Canada, and Japan, are among the healthiest, wealthiest, and safest in the world. Secularization highly correlates with belief in science, increased vaccination rates, higher education levels, stronger safety nets, and greater support for gay rights, women reproductive rights, and universal health care. The decline of organized religion can be a progressive force for good. But don't assume all secular people are progressive, said Henry Olson in the Washington Post. Despite secular cultures in Western Europe, Canada, and Australia, conservative parties remain strong. In Australia, only 8% of the public is church-going, yet the conservative Liberal National Coalition has won the last three national elections. That suggests that Republicans aren't doomed to political irrelevance as U.S. religious affiliation wanes, if they adapt to, rather than resist, the transformation. Some shorter notes. Gun sales broke an all-time record in March, according to FBI statistics on background checks. The Bureau conducted more than 4.5 million checks, up from the prior record set in January, 4,300,000. Gun sellers cited stimulus checks and the threat of gun safety legislation after two mass shootings as the drivers behind the boom in sales. The Biden administration has rolled back Trump-era rules that prohibited transgender troops from enlisting and serving openly in the military. The new policy will allow trans people to serve so long as they have been stable in the preferred gender for 18 months. Activists estimate there are nearly 15,000 transgender troops in the military. The FDA has authorized two rapid at-home coronavirus tests that are expected to be sold over-the-counter without a prescription within the coming weeks. The two tests are Abbott's Binax Now test, and Quidel's QuickView, and are expected to cost from $7 to $10 per test. On the poll watch, 72% of Americans support requiring a form of identification to vote. 60% support automatically registering citizens to vote when they get their driver's license. 53% are in favor of allowing same-day registration and voting. And 52% back no-excuse mail-in voting. 77% of Americans say the COVID situation is improving, up from 33% in January. Just 35% are concerned about getting COVID-19, the lowest percentage in a year. And we'll finish with a quote from J.R.R. Tolkien, who says, "All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.